Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hello. Have you thought about entering the legal nurse consulting practice? Have you thought about perhaps expanding your current legal nursing role? Please join Patricia Iyer, who is my friend and colleague, and myself, Barbara Levin, on October 23, 24, 25, 2020, as we host the second virtual Legal Nurse Consulting Success Conference. We have a diverse panel of speakers and exciting topics. One of the topics that will be addressed will include alternative roles for legal nurse consultants. This will include the differences between DME and IME, which is defense medical examinations and independent medical examinations, how you can utilize cost projections within your role as a legal nurse consultant. What about workman's compensation? Have you ever thought about delving into that area? We know that these areas require a nursing background to give the most up-to-date current information because you, the nurse, understand these areas and understand nursing and medicine. And have you ever thought about entering and assisting in the role of mediations? These topics and more will be presented during our conference. Please join us October 23, 24, 25, 2020, as we explore these topics and more. Please see the link below, lnc.tips/October2020virtual. We look forward to seeing you.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have with me today Ananya Dada, who is an emergency medicine pediatric nurse practitioner. She has also founded Impact Clinical Strategy Consultants, which is a healthcare consulting firm, and that helps emergency departments. And UC, tell me what UC is, Ananya.
Urgent care.
Urgent care. Okay, thank you. I was drawing a complete blank on that, okay. Thinking, no, it's not utilization review. No, okay. Thank you.
No problem.
She helps emergency departments and urgent care centers improve their operations. Ananya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ms. Iyer. I really appreciate it. And thank you for allowing me to speak to you and your audience today.
And one thing we didn't cover as we were getting ready is that I respond better to Pat rather than Mrs. Iyer, which makes me feel about 100 years old.
Okay, noted. Thank you.
That's right. You can call me Pat.
Perfect.
I met Ananya through a mutual friend and acquaintance who suggested that we have a talk about her background. And I realized in speaking with her that she has great experience to bring to you as a legal nurse consultant listening to this podcast. Tell us a little bit about your background, your training. You're an emergency medicine pediatric nurse practitioner, which puts you in a narrow niche of people with expertise. How did you get to that point?
Absolutely. So I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, where I did my undergraduate in my bachelor's of science in nursing there. And I quickly started my nursing journey as a critical care nurse. And I started to notice that I really wanted to, and I longed for, to be a part of a team in a more autonomous way in the patient's child's care. So that really led me to seek my master's in nursing and become a pediatric nurse practitioner. And I also wanted to look at the social determinants of health, which I felt that was missing in my education. So I also sought my master's in public health. And I combined those two while I practiced as an ER nurse practitioner in Philadelphia. And that has been kind of my journey for the last 10 years in nursing up until now. And recently I founded a healthcare consulting firm helping emergency departments and urgent cares, as you said.
Excellent. It sounds like you've gotten a lot of education that has helped you in looking at the people that you serve, both from an administrative or an overview perspective, as well as a clinical level.
Absolutely. I think that clinicians honestly are an untapped resource in the healthcare industry in terms of how much they know and are fielding and troubleshooting and investigating challenges, you know, as we've faced in the last 6 months, especially all the time in their work, in addition to providing care for patients. So I've been able to be on both on different sides of the fence, and I really appreciate all of the lessons that I've learned.
And one of the things that we talked about in terms of being in this arena is that legal nurse consultants sometimes are consulted by attorneys on child abuse cases. And I'm thinking that with your background in emergency department and pediatric nurse practitioner, that you have encountered patients where there's been a suspicion or the story doesn't match what the parents or the caretaker says happened to the child. Can you tell us, is that something that has been part of your clinical background?
Yes. So unfortunately, this was a very prevalent type of complaint and diagnosis that we saw in the pediatric ER. We saw, and we would do pretty much one patient a shift. That's how commonly as a nurse practitioner that I would see these type of cases. Now, not all of them were brought in unstable. So most of them were stable patients. And the way in which the complaint would be manifested could be a foster parent. It could be court ordered examination. It could be suspected child abuse, like you said. So there's different ways that the child would present, but something related to a non-accidental trauma we would see about once a shift. So it was very common, unfortunately, in my practice.
Take us through what were some of the common presentations, the symptoms that would cause the parents, or I'll just say the parents, even though we know that could be any of the entities that you're talking about, but what would bring that child into the emergency department?
That's a great question. So it varies. So we would see things such as direct disclosures from a child, of someone hitting them or inflicting pain. And otherwise, it could be complaints from teachers writing a note for further investigation that they saw bruising that was inappropriate, or the child looked malnourished and neglected. And then it could go to the other side of the spectrum where we would see child in acute abdominal pain, which abdominal trauma is one of the top child abuse experiences that we see. It could be unexplained bruising. It could be a lot of orthopedic injuries that the mechanism just does not align with the reported history. So it could be anywhere along that spectrum.
And then in the process of working up the child, did it happen that you would encounter things like fractures that would appear on x-ray and yet there wouldn't be any history of trauma?
Oftentimes that would happen. It could be an old rib fracture that was healing. It could be just unexplained things that were not brought into the history by the parent or the caregiver that we would note. And of course, there's also obvious fractures that the patient would be experiencing, displacements, bruising, things of that nature too.
I got involved in a case several years ago involving American parents who adopted two brothers from a Russian orphanage. When they went over to pick up the one brother, they found out he had another brother, so they decided to bring both kids back. And the one who became the center of this suit was probably a fetal alcohol syndrome child. The attorney who hired me was defending the parents who were brought into a criminal action because the boy was brought into the ER. He was extremely cold. They found undigested beans in his stomach and some fractures of his fingers that didn't connect with trauma. And the parent's story was that he would be acting out, so they would put him into a playpen, and he was breaking his hand by hitting hard objects. The grandmother said that the playpen was down by the furnace, and that's why the child was so cold, and they used that to punish him. And ultimately, the court system decided that the parents were indeed the ones inflicting the trauma. It was a fascinating case because it brought me into whole areas that I had never knew anything about, including the conditions in Russian orphanages, the lack of medical records about this child, what is plausible in terms of injuries. Could the hypothermia have been related to an electrolyte imbalance? There were all things that we were grasping at to try to defend these parents, but the grandmother's testimony was it. You know, she was the person in the family who provided the most credible explanation. There were brothers and sisters who were talking about what was going on, and that was kind of discounted. But when the grandmother came in and said, this is what was really happening, that was the end of the ability to defend the parents. Yeah. And in the process of working on this case, which took several months, I got all kinds of medical records, including the Child Protective Services records. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit with us about the team of people who become involved, starting from the responsibilities of the nurses to report, and then who gets brought in to do an investigation.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that story. Unfortunately, there's so many stories similar to that, but I think that in child abuse cases, we as clinicians are learning and doing better in terms of taking a more multidisciplinary approach. And something I didn't mention earlier is that, you know, I am not an expert in child abuse in terms of there are child abuse pediatricians who are trained and have fellowships in this, and they are the ultimate experts. So I wanted to say that. But in terms of a team, when a child is brought in, whether they are suspected child abuse or there's an unclear history, we first determine in the emergency department, you know, obviously if the patient is stable or not. If it's an acute trauma, then you address it that way. However, if it's a stable patient, we take a really good history, beginning from triage from the caregiver. And then initially the nurse practitioner or physician in charge will be taking the first primary exam of the patient. And if the patient's stable, then we move along to determining the best course of action based on that assessment, as well as the history, and as well as the patient's developmental age and stages. So if there is something that is concerning, then we involve immediately a child abuse pediatrician. We consult them. If there's not one available, then we have to look at the protocols in place for the hospital. But oftentimes we also involve trauma, which is also interchangeable with surgery teams, as well as if there's any orthopedic injuries, we would involve that team. If there's any ophthalmology consults that are necessary, those are typically the core medical consults that we see. And then, of course, we're involving social work. So social workers in-house, they are a great resource for a dynamic team. Then we involve the local child protection services. And of course, if we need to get a police report involved, that would be, at this time, it would take place.
Now, I'm thinking about this from the standpoint of what happens when the child comes into the emergency department, has injuries where there's a suspicion of abuse. Under what circumstances does the child leave the ER with the parents versus under what circumstances does the child get placed in a foster family?
That's a great question. I think it really requires a very thorough history from the caregiver and then an examination and whatever the workup is entailed. So the first thing is medically clearing that child. So whatever indications are, whether it's if it's an infant, then you do an entire workup, including a CT scan, lots of blood work, making sure there's no head to toe, you do a skeletal survey. So it would be very thorough. And then if it was a toddler, school age child, and if it was one focused issue, then it would be dependent on the history there. And then also we would get CPS involved, so Child Protection Services, and make a joint decision. Oftentimes, you know, the biggest thing is making sure that the patient or the client is not returned to an unsafe environment. So that is a survey that Child Protection often does with the information that we're able to give them. So once the patient is medically cleared, then Child Protection really works very closely with the medical team in order to make that decision. And if there's a safety place involved, there are a lot of factors that go into how long that's going to be and who is going to be in charge as the guardian now of the patient. So it really, it depends on the situation and the severity of the medical complaints.
I'm thinking about what it's like from the child's perspective of being taken away from the only family the child knows.
Absolutely.
That must be traumatic too.
Absolutely. The entire, you know, visit and scenario is absolutely traumatic. However, I think it's really important to keep in mind that despite how old a child is, a lot of times disclosures from the child does not happen in terms of fear and retaliation. And like you said, they don't want to be separated from their family. However, it's really important that we take a look at not only verbal disclosure from the child, but nonverbal. So their affect, their engagement with our staff, if they're malnourished or neglected, things that they don't necessarily are not telling us that we need to really keep a vigilant eye on. Those are important. So we refocus our entire, interest back into the child and how we can help them.
I would think it would be challenging, and I know this is something that legal nurse consultants get involved in, of trying to differentiate between what is an accidental injury, what is a deliberate injury. I was just thinking about my two sons, 7 years apart, who were roughhousing one day, and my younger son brought his leg up at the same time that his brother was bringing his hand down, and we thought that my younger son's leg was hit hard enough to break the bone because there was so much force. It wasn't a deliberate strike, but it was just that, if you're watching the YouTube video, I'm raising my hand down and striking the side of my fingers. It was just that accident of timing. And of course, being the concerned nurse, I took my son to the emergency department, who by the time we got to the parking lot, he was perfectly fine. And I was wondering whether I was even wasting everyone's time, but the obligatory x-ray was done and there was nothing fractured. And I think as you're talking about toddlers, the accidents that occur at that age, you know, how do you differentiate, particularly with infants and toddlers who can't explain what happened? You know, maybe they were running and they fell and broke an arm, as opposed to somebody deliberately breaking their arm. But tell us a little bit more about that, because that's really what we get involved in as legal nurse consultants, is helping attorneys understand the mechanism of injury, how much force it takes to break a bone, for example. Am I asking that question coherently enough that you can follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yes. And I think that's often the dilemma in healthcare that we are in. So to kind of clarify, our role in being a healthcare professional as a provider is to understand and get a really good history as well as physical exam. So the things that we're really looking for is any disclosures. We're looking for a very airtight history from the caregiver that is not evolving, that's not changing. We're looking for an excellent physical examination on our behalf. And then we're looking for developmental appropriateness and the mechanism that's being explained to us, if that all fits. Now, with any infant, you know, especially under 4 to 6 months, bruising is not appropriate. And we always have to keep in mind, you know, if the child is non-mobile and they're an infant, then they shouldn't be having any type of bruising, which we can go into in detail. So keeping that in mind as an LNC is extremely important, that developmental stage, because that's going to drive a lot of piecing together the whole puzzle. So as in the actual clinical setting, our main goal is to really get that understanding of, does this mechanism make sense with what we're seeing? And how much of a workup do we need to do? Is this patient stable? You know, have we investigated everything to keep this child safe and healthy? And once that patient is medically cleared, then we hand off the decision for the disposition of that child to the child protection and the determination of how it will be investigated and the appropriateness. We can give recommendations based on our understanding as clinicians of, is this appropriate or not? Does this make sense with the mechanism? We can provide that those recommendations, but our role is really not to necessarily determine that, you know, if this is, you know, inappropriate or not in that moment. We have to really work closely with child protection to make that determination.
And I would think that that would be challenging. That's what keeps people awake at night and gives them nightmares of, did I do the right thing? The obvious extremes are easy to spot. The cigarette burns on the skin of an infant that shrieks abuse, but it's these subtler areas that are the problem. The mother's boyfriend who claims that the child fell off the changing table when the child might have been thrown off, for example. The caretakers who lie very convincingly. And I would imagine that that has happened to you. Have you sat there in an ER one time and has it ever happened that you looked at the person and said, I know you are lying, but you are such a good liar?
Unfortunately, a lot of clinicians, including myself, have been in that situation. And, you know, it's really, the onus is on us as clinicians to protect that child and make sure that they're safe and healthy and that we are making the most sound decision with all of the information that we're gathering. So we almost have to put on an investigator hat at that point and really get all of the information that we can. So the four things that I really focus on in these situations is, like we talked about, mechanism of injury, physical findings, getting an excellent history that's not evolving. So when the patient is coming in, they're giving multiple histories, one to the nurse, one to the provider. If there's a multidisciplinary team, they will be asking again. So really making sure that evolution does not change drastically. That's important to know. And then, of course, keying in the developmental stages. So you're gathering this information constantly when seeking this interviewing stage with the caregiver. So there have been incidences, you know, of course, where this has come up, but it is really important to discern that and be able to pinpoint any discrepancies in the storytelling.
A challenging role.
Absolutely.
Now you're in this role, you're in the heat of the situation, in the moment. Legal nurse consultants are looking at this after the fact. They might be working with a criminal defense attorney or with a prosecutor trying to evaluate the case retrospectively. trying to determine where is the credibility associated with this type of role or this type of situation. Do you have any tips that you can share with LNCs who are looking at these cases from that perspective? Maybe the initial providers have made their determination, but the criminal defense attorney is asserting, no, it's not the way that it happened. You know, there's another plausible explanation. What can you share with us that would help make that role easier for the legal nurse consultant of that coming up with a defense, for example?
Absolutely. I think that it's a very challenging case for LNCs, but I think there are a few things to keep in mind. And so you beginning, you know, just at the top is really fine-tooth combing your documentation of the visits, of the medical chart. And creating a airtight medical chronology is going to be very, very important. In addition to that, so doing a more deep dive into whatever specific the case is, whether it's an abdominal trauma, for example, taking a look at the medical standards for that care. So what are the protocols in place that were followed? What is the best practices for taking care of abdominal trauma? Was that done? And was the non-accidental trauma workup, the general workup done? So documentation, disposition, disclosures, all of these things are going to come into play. And then really taking a deep dive into the institution's protocols and then access to the specialist. Was a child abuse pediatrician consulted? Do they have access to one? And what was their testimony? What was their recommendations? Was that followed? And then slowly piecing together the views of all the consultants and specialists that were in play with the patient. So if there was trauma involved, if there was child abuse pediatrician involved and the general team, does everyone's opinion align in terms of recommendations? And was that followed? Are there any discrepancies in the timeline or any discrepancies in recommendation and second opinions? That's really important to have a look at. I think that will give a lot of information as to if there's credibility in what you're saying. And then of course, lastly, like I was mentioning, you know, our job is really not to make the determination of any criminal activity. However, it's our job is to make sure the patient is safe and healthy. What were the interpretations of the findings that were put in the medical decision-making part of the chart? What was gleaned from the diagnostics and the examination and the history? What was the documentation leaning towards? That's really important to pull out. And I think that, you know, it's really important to know that in the emergency department, this is just one snapshot of the patient's life and one presentation. So if possible, to look at the pediatrician's records and see, working with the, their local pediatrician to see if you can look at a longer timeline. And that will help you to determine, you know, are there pattern injuries occurring? Are there injuries in different stages of healing occurring? Are there multiple injuries constantly occurring? And then of course, having in the back of your mind, the developmental stages and having a very low threshold for injuries for infants. Infants, a lot of times, is an area of focus that we lose focus on. So it's extremely important to have a low threshold for any type of injury for an infant and keep that in mind.
And as you're talking, I'm thinking about what a blessing it is to work in a metropolitan area where you have a child abuse pediatrician. And the reality is that for like the small rural parts of this country or for people listening from other countries, there's a family practice doctor who's probably delivering the care who has a very big responsibility for being suspicious when there's reason to be suspicious, who doesn't have the resources that are available in a university emergency setting. You know, we have the two extremes from very limited resources to all the resources available. And yet it's so challenging for both ends of the spectrum.
Absolutely. And that can definitely happen. And I think in those circumstances, it's really important for the family practice doctor or pediatrician or anyone who doesn't have access to specialists and consultants in the same way, is to really be abreast on local guidelines for being a mandatory reporter and what is considered guidelines or areas that you would need to report as a provider. And then, of course, remembering physical examination and developmental stages. So a few things that in child abuse that's really important, acronyms that we talk about is TEN4. So TEN4, and that stands for torso, ears, and neck. If you see any of these areas with bruising in a child under less than four, that is a red flag and concern for a possible non-accidental trauma. Of course, you need to investigate that. And in infants, like we mentioned before, if they're non-mobile and infants and they have any type of bruising, especially in the frenulum, angle of the jaw, cheek, eyes, or any type of subconjunctival hemorrhage, that's definitely raises a lot of red flags. So those are cannot miss things that a pediatrician or a provider would really need to remember. And then in terms of resources, when you have a lack of resources, I think creating a collaboration with local providers is going to be really important on what is the appropriate protocol and what is everyone doing in terms of referring, and how do you handle non-accidental traumas prior to going to the emergency room. So tapping into excellent resources would be American Academy of Pediatrics has excellent conferences and lots of literature on child abuse, both for the professional as well as for the parent. The American Professional Society on Child Abuse of Children, APSAC.org, they have excellent resources on their own conferences, and they are a great expertise in this field. And then, of course, if you're able to reach out to local children's hospitals, whether, you know, no matter how far away it is, it's really important to gain that trust and relationship with child abuse pediatricians if you have access, or even the local ER pediatricians, to know and have an understanding of when is appropriate to send a child, what are some protocols in place you can put in your own office, and creating that relationship, I think, would be really important.
You've given us a lot to think about today. How can our listeners find out more about you and the services that you offer?
Absolutely. I really appreciate this opportunity. Anyone who's interested in learning more about how I help emergency departments and urgent cares can contact me on my website on www.impactclinicalstrategy.com, which is soon to launch, and also directly via email. So my name, ANANYA. At impactclinicalstrategy.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Ananya.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Ananya Dada, and Pat and I are talking about child abuse. Ananya is available for emergency department pediatric nurse practitioner cases as an expert witness, and would be a great resource for you if you're analyzing a case and you need some assistance from an individual who has spent years looking at these non-accidental trauma cases, as well as other types of taking care of pediatric patients in emergency departments. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have just finished speaking with Ananya Dada, who is an emergency medicine pediatric nurse practitioner. We've been talking about a subject that chills all of us, which is non-accidental trauma and child abuse and the symptoms and signs that a nurse practitioner would be looking for when a patient or a child is brought into the emergency department. What will our listeners get from being able to watch this podcast on our YouTube channel or listen to it on our audio channels?
In this episode, we really take a deep dive into understanding the role of a clinician, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a nurse, and how it's not focused on criminal behavior, but focused on taking apart the documentation, putting it together through a thorough timeline, and understanding how we can better piece together the medical interpretation for child abuse cases.
Thank you, Ananya. And to you who's watching this, be sure to look for the podcast with Ananya Datta so that you can learn more about this subject and how you as a legal nurse consultant may be involved in helping attorneys, either criminal defense attorneys or prosecutors, with these types of cases.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.